listening to the Whale Scout Podcast with your host, Whitney Neggebauer.
Welcome to the Whale Scout Podcast, everyone. My name is Whitney Neggebauer, and I'm the Director of Whale Scout. Today is Friday, March 1st, 2019. And today on the podcast, we have a really, really exciting guest, Robin Baird from Cascadia Research Collective. And he does work, well, he started doing work in the Pacific Northwest on marine mammals and killer whales up in our neck of the woods, and then has expanded into doing work in Hawaii on some of the lesser well-known toothed whales that live in those waters. And so we'll be talking about those whales, their conservation status, what's going on in Hawaii, which is fascinating, and also drawing some comparisons to conservation efforts that are happening up here with the southern resident killer whales. But first, I want to let you know about some of the really exciting events coming up just in the month of March. Things are getting really busy, and so I'll just let you know about a few events that are coming up in March. On the 10th, Whale Scout is hosting our second Sunday sightings program. So it's on a Sunday, of course. So check our website and Facebook for more details in the next week or so as we list all of the different sites around Puget Sound where you can go out. They're all public, and meet up with some of our naturalists to just see what you might find that day. Maybe there'll be whales. Maybe there'll be interesting species of birds or other marine mammals. And you can just chat and learn from our naturalists. And it's totally free. On March 15th and 16th, the Whale Museum is hosting a Gear Up workshop. And a lot of this has to do with oil spill preparedness and information. So it should be a really great workshop. March 30th, Whale Scout is hosting a helping out event at Idlewood Beach Park, which is in Redmond. And it's a cool park. It's got Idlewood Creek flowing right into Lake Sammamish. And both the lake shoreline and the stream are both important for our salmon. A lot of the salmon that go through there are both wild and hatchery origin fish that are headed towards the Issaquah hatchery. So we're working to do everything that we can to make the habitat better. Lake Sammamish is also where a critical species of kokanee live, and they are struggling with conditions in the lake. So more about that. You can come join us and learn more. March 31st, the very next day, I'm giving a talk at the Edmonds Demonstration Garden at 1 o'clock, and I'll be sharing about our southern resident killer whales, the work that Whale Scout does, and how everyone can get involved. So check out those on our Facebook page and website, whalescout.org and facebook.com/whalescout for more information. And now, Robin Baird. We are back here on the Whale Scout Podcast today. We are joined by Robin Baird of Cascadia Research Collective, based in Olympia. And I am so excited to have you on our podcast today. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's nice to talk with you.
So you've done some research here in the Pacific Northwest, and you also do research in Hawaii. So living here in Washington State, how did you get involved with projects that are going on halfway across the ocean in Hawaii?
Yeah, I actually, before I moved to Washington State, I started the work in Hawaii back in 1999. I had been living in Nova Scotia and got offered a job out there, so moved out there and started up a number of projects. And it wasn't for a couple of years before I actually moved to Olympia and started working with Cascadia, but ever since I've been based here in Olympia, but doing the majority of my field work in Hawaii.
When most people hear about whales in Hawaii, their mind instantly goes to the humpbacks. But as I understand it, those critters are not the ones that you are studying. Can you explain all the different species that are in Hawaii and which ones you're studying?
Yeah, when I first started working there, I wanted to avoid overlap or competition with the other researchers who are working in the area, and pretty much all the researchers working on whales were working on humpbacks, and all the researchers working on dolphins were working on spinner dolphins. So instead of focusing on either of those, I started off right away with a species that I knew was in the area that had really not received any attention, which were false killer whales, and also worked with some of the other species of dolphins like bottlenose dolphins and pantropical spotted dolphins. And over the years, that work has expanded to include about a dozen different species of resident whales and dolphins that are in the islands, and that includes pilot whales, two different species of beaked whales, pygmy killer whales, melon-headed whales, rough-toothed dolphins, and a few others. So it's one of the most interesting things of working in Hawaii is the incredible diversity of species that are there, and in particular the diversity of resident species.
Yeah, I was just thinking, though, on a scale of, you know, diversity, compared to the rest of the world, where would Hawaii fall?
Well, there's certainly lots of areas that have a higher diversity overall, and the Gulf of California, for example, is a good example of that. But what makes Hawaii unique is the large number of resident species, and it all relates back to the location of the islands and the oceanography of the area. When you think about Hawaii, it's the most isolated archipelago in the world, and it's located in the middle of a very low productivity ocean. The central tropical Pacific is basically a biological desert, and so what's happened over probably tens or hundreds of thousands of years is all of these open ocean species that are known to be out there have basically found the islands and colonized the islands. And the species I mentioned right at the beginning, false killer whales, are one example where, based on the genetics, the false killer whale population around the main Hawaiian Islands was probably colonized by a single social group. All the individuals in the population are very closely related genetically. And so I don't know of anywhere else in the world, any other island area like that, where there's so many resident species.
So people are probably thinking now, they're very familiar with southern resident killer whales. What's the difference between those guys and the false killer whales that you're describing?
Yeah, well, false killer whales are originally got their name from similarities in the skull and the teeth with killer whales. The genus for false killer whale is Pseudorca, and they were described originally from a skull. So that's where the similarity in name comes from. They are actually closely related to killer whales, and they as well as species like pilot whales and pygmy killer whales and melon-headed whales, and they share a lot of similar life history traits and behavioral traits. They're long-lived. They don't start reproducing till they're about 10 years old for females, and probably the late teens for males, which is very similar to killer whales. They only give birth to one calf probably every 6 or 7 years, which is actually a little bit longer than killer whale populations. And like killer whales and also like pilot whales, the females go through menopause and will stop reproducing in the case of false killer whales in their early 40s, but will live another 10 or 20 or more years after that. And so all of those similarities in life history bring up another sort of thing that they share in common with southern resident killer whales and other killer whale populations, which is that they're a species that is subject to the kinds of interactions with humans that can really influence their populations. So, you know, those species are ones that if something is in the case of killer whales, southern resident killer whales, the problem is not enough food, but in the case of false killer whales, the problem appears to be interactions with fisheries and incidental mortality in fisheries. And those life history traits make it difficult for a population to be able to sustain or recover from those types of human interactions.
So are these whales listed as endangered? And what about some of the other species that live in the Hawaiian Islands? And what's their conservation status?
Yeah. Of all the species in Hawaii, I think false killer whales are probably the ones that are most at risk. And they were actually listed as endangered in the main Hawaiian Island insular population was listed as endangered in 2012. So it's been a relatively recent listing and a recent discovery of the problems that the populations are facing. The main Hawaiian Island population is relatively small, sort of in the 150 to 170 individual range, and we don't really have the same kind of detailed census that occurs every year for southern residents, where every individual in the population is known. But like southern resident killer whales, we really rely a lot on citizen science for learning more about the population. We get a lot of photographs from people who work on the water off the different islands or play on the water, and those photos are really what we're able to use to help both estimate the abundance of the population find out, you know, who's given birth recently, are able to use the photos to assess whether or not individuals have injuries from entanglements or hooking, and it really makes a huge difference in our ability to monitor and understand the population.
So could you share a little bit more about these fishery interactions? Are they, you know, snagging fish off lines, or what's happening there?
Yeah, well, and it's something else that they share with killer whales, is that pretty much what false killer whales in Hawaii like to eat are all species of fish that humans also like to eat. So in the case of killer whales, it's Chinook salmon and occasionally chum and coho salmon. In the case of false killer whales in Hawaii, they're feeding on species like yellowfin tuna, mahi-mahi, ono or wahoo, some of the other jacks, things like aluas that are a lot of fishing pressure, and you know, similar to killer whales up in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska, false killer whales have learned that if there's a fish on the end of a line, that's an easy source of food. So fortunately, that's not something that southern resident killer whales have really ever picked up on, but false killer whales are well known and have been for a long time to take fish off of lines. And most of the fisheries in Hawaii are hook and line fisheries, trolling or other types of hook and line fisheries, and false killer whales will if they see a fish on the end of the line, they'll at least some of the time try to take it. And a lot of the time, I think they're able to get the fish off without getting hooked, but there's at least some proportion of the cases where they get hooked themselves. And we know from observer program in the longline fishery, which is an offshore fishery and are mainly having interactions with pelagic false killer whales, that when they get hooked, they can struggle against the line. Injuries can occur, and we're able to use those types of injuries either on the dorsal fin or injuries on the mouth line where an animal's been hooked and it's been sort of ripped out, to get an idea of what proportion of the population might be interacting with fisheries. And it's almost a quarter of the individuals that we have some evidence of these types of interactions. So a good proportion of the population is at least occasionally taking fish from lines.
And so are they going on to then die from their injuries, or what happens?
Yeah, it's a good question. We don't really know the answer. And a lot of that comes down to, well, you think about killer whales in the Pacific Northwest, and only a small proportion of the animals that die ever are found and wash up. And in Hawaii, it's an even lower proportion, just a couple percent of individuals that we know are dying are ever found. And a lot of that relates to the large number of tiger sharks that are in the area. And if an animal dies, it gets scavenged by tiger sharks fairly quickly. But if they ingest hooks, well, I mean, there's a couple ways they can die from this type of interaction. If they're entangled, they could drown. And we know from the longline observer program that happens at least occasionally. But they can also ingest the hook and then break the line. And from some work that was done by Randy Wells and colleagues down in Florida with bottlenose dolphins, if an animal ingests the hook, there's about a 50% chance that it's going to die from that. And it may not die quickly. It may be, especially if there's any entangled gear, or if there's any gear still attached to the hook, a leader or a line, then what happens is those hooks can end up in the stomach, and the animal may try to regurgitate the hook. The hook could, you know, perforate the digestive system, or in the process of trying to regurgitate the hook, can end up getting entangled and killing the animal. So it's a insidious problem in the sense that it's sort of out of sight and may happen, you know, weeks or months after the animal actually gets hooked. So it's not something that's easy to monitor or easy to record. And the other thing that makes it difficult to understand sort of the magnitude of the problem is that most of the areas where we work or where tour operators or other folks who work on the water spend their time are on the leeward side of the islands, the west side of the islands, where it's relatively calm. But we know from our satellite tagging work with false cuttle whales that they spend the majority of their time elsewhere. So they spend a lot of time on the windward sides of the islands and in the channels between the islands. So our sightings are few and far between.
Has anything been done to try to regulate or control or modify these fisheries to prevent these sort of negative interactions?
Well, there's the fisheries in Hawaii sort of fall into two categories. There's the longline fishery, which is a relatively small number of boats, about 150 boats, and that's probably the most economically important fishery in Hawaii. And with that fishery, there's a take reduction team that was formed back in 2010 and a lot of efforts to try to reduce false cuttle whale bycatch in that fishery. And then there's all the other fisheries. And all the other fisheries, there's probably 3,000 or more small boats that are basically folks that go out in small boats for commercial fishing, and probably several thousand more that recreationally fish. And in those fisheries, nothing has been done. But I think there's some potential for the lessons that have been learned from the offshore longline fishery to potentially be transferred over to some of the nearshore fisheries. And the big problem is the offshore longline fishery. Even I mentioned the take reduction team that's been in place now since 2010. You know, I'm a member of the team, and we came up with a plan to reduce bycatch, or what we thought would reduce bycatch, back in 2010, and that went into effect in 2013. But we're now more than 5 years into it. We have pretty good evidence that the plan's not working quite the way we had hoped. And in theory, it's a great idea. So when you think about it, when a false cuttle whale takes a fish off a line, if it gets hooked, and then struggles against the line, one way of allowing the whale to get free is to make the hook the weakest link in the chain. So what was implemented as part of this take reduction plan was that the fishermen had to change the type of hooks they're using to a certain maximum wire diameter to basically come up with weak circle hooks. And the branch line, the line that goes from the hook to the main line, had to be a minimum of a certain diameter, so we'd have strong branch lines and weak circle hooks, and that would make the hook the weakest link, allow an animal that's struggling to potentially straighten the hook and get off. And what we've learned through the observer program in that fishery is that the hooks aren't weak enough and the branch lines aren't strong enough, and so instead of straightening the hooks, they're straightening some of the hooks, but instead of straightening the majority of the hooks, a lot of the time the branch line is just breaking, and a whale is swimming away with the hook and a bunch of line, or animals are just getting killed outright. So the team has been discussing for quite a while now and trying to come up with a consensus on, you know, how much weaker can the hooks be made, how much stronger can the branch lines be made, what other things are needed to be included in the fishery, things like electronic monitoring to make sure the fishermen are doing what they're supposed to be doing in terms of how they handle the gear and just not cutting the lines. So there's still a lot of steps that are needed, but the nice thing about these take reduction teams is that they're a group of people that include longline fishermen, includes researchers, includes conservationists. So everyone basically tries to work together to come up with a consensus plan that can be used to address the problem without, you know, putting the fishermen out of business type kind of thing.
Right. I would imagine that the resistance would be from fishermen not wanting the hooks to break because of the weight of a fish. I mean, how big are these fish?
Yeah, no, and that's exactly right. You know, the fishery is targeting big eye tuna, and a large big eye tuna can be, you know, 150, 200 pounds. So
they,
from a fisherman's perspective, they want the strongest hooks possible and the strongest branch lines possible, so it basically requires them to make some changes that means they either have to work harder to keep the fish, or they may lose a few large fish. And back when we originally came up with the plan, National Marine Fisheries Service did a hook experiment where they went out on longline boats with two different types of hooks, and tried to see then, okay, if we use a weaker hook and a stronger hook, are the weaker hooks going to result in a substantially lower catch? And with that early experiment, they didn't. And so now with this new plan that we're talking about, with even weaker hooks and stronger branch lines, I think that NIMS is probably going to go out and do another one of these weak hook experiments. So find out what the actual economic effects on the fishery may be. And I think what everyone hopes is that they're going to be relatively minor and the fishermen are going to accept that, but that's something that's yet to be determined. So it's sort of a classic case of how do you reconcile the economic interests and the economic losses potentially in one group of people in order to change their behavior in a way that's going to reduce the impacts that they have on species that they're not intending to have impacts on, and includes not just false killer whales, but there are other species of whales and dolphins that are hooked in that fishery as well. But false killer whales just happen to be the most frequently recorded species that are hooked in the longline fishery.
And what about the fish themselves? Are there any that are at risk of being overfished?
Well, that's a good question. And, you know, around the main Hawaiian Islands, the best evidence that the population has had some level of overfishing really relates to the size of the fish that are caught today compared to the size of the fish that were caught, say, in the 1940s or in the 1950s. And the state of Hawaii has kept records on the size of fish that are caught commercially in Hawaii for a long time. And around the main Hawaiian Islands, the yellowfin tuna that are caught today are about half the weight of what the yellowfin tuna that were caught back in the 40s and 50s. So the fish are smaller now than they used to be. And if you talk to old-time fishermen, you know, their catch rates were much higher back in the day. But, you know, it's a tough one because there's some other species of fish like mahi-mahi, which we see false killer whales eat mahi-mahi on a pretty regular basis. It's actually the most frequently recorded species that we see false killer whales catch. Mahi-mahi populations have actually increased in the last 30 or 40 years, and it's thought that the reason they've increased is because some of the larger fish populations, things like yellowfin tuna and billfish, have declined. And so, you know, we don't have with southern resident killer whales, we know at least during the summer months, they're Chinook specialists, and they certainly diversify their prey choice to chum salmon in the fall and some coho and steelhead. With false killer whales in Hawaii, we don't have such strong evidence of specialization, so they probably have a fair amount of flexibility in terms of what types of fish they're catching. And that's good, obviously, because if one species like elephant tuna, if there's a lot fewer of them or if they're a lot smaller, then they have to work a lot harder to catch them. And we're hoping that what the case is that, you know, they can feed on things like mahi-mahi that are doing well. And that's another comparison between, you know, killer whales in the Pacific Northwest and false killer whales in Hawaii. And, you know, one of the biggest problems with that's been identified in recent years is these animals in the Pacific Northwest that are just clearly emaciated and are not are nutritionally stressed. And we don't see that with false killer whales in Hawaii. The individuals we've seen appear to be fairly robust. It's extremely rare, I would say, to see really skinny individuals. So I don't think the problem is a lack of food there. It's more this overlap between what they're feeding on and what humans like to feed on, and the fact that, you know, they've learned to get the fish off the lines and the risk that entails.
Are there any big threats to whales in Hawaii? You know, you hear a lot in the news about Navy sonar that's being tested near the Hawaiian Islands. Have you done any research into that or any other threats?
Yeah, well, you know, it goes back to what I said earlier about the high diversity in Hawaii. We know, particularly off the island of Hawaii, that there's resident populations of Cuvier's beaked whales and Blainville's beaked whales, as well as dwarf sperm whales and pygmy killer whales, and all of those species, as well as melon-headed whales, which are also resident to the island, are species that are known or strongly suspected to be affected by Navy sonar. And we have done some work off of the island of Kauai and Niihau, where the Navy does most of their sonar testing and training activities in Hawaii. And what we found is that while there are resident populations of some other species off Kauai and Niihau, so that includes bottlenose dolphins, spinner dolphins, rough-toothed dolphins, and pilot whales, the species that are most susceptible to Navy sonar are either extremely rare off of those islands or they're not resident there, or both. And so I think that reflects a long-term change, and the Navy has been using sonar regularly there a couple times a year at least for probably 30 or 40 years, and I think most of the really sensitive species have just abandoned the area, at least the resident populations. And you know, it's interesting because you compare that to some areas where there are resident populations of Cuvier's beaked whales in areas where the Navy regularly undertakes testing activities. And the difference with Hawaii is that it's such a low productivity area, such a low density area, that the choice that the animals have to make of staying or going is such that if it was a really important area to them, really high density of food, then individuals may learn to tolerate or otherwise put up with the exposure to Navy sonar. But in an area where, you know, it's not a highly productive area in the first place, the choice of whether to stay or go is different. And I think that's what's happened off Kauai and Niihau for some of these really sensitive species.
Wow. It kind of makes you think, too, about the training area off the coast of Washington. Do you think anything similar is going on there?
Well, I think back to, I started working in originally in British Columbia back in the late 1980s, mid and late 1980s, and, you know, so much of the research on whales and dolphins in Washington State and British Columbia have focused on these relatively common inshore species, in particular killer whales, gray whales, also humpback whales. And once you get out onto the continental slope or off the continental slope off the outer Washington coast, there's really very, very little research out there. So, you know, there could be resident populations of things like Baird's beaked whales or Hub's beaked whales out there, and we just wouldn't know it because there's been virtually no research out in those areas. No one's out trying to get photos and setting up a photo ID catalog, and that's what we found in Hawaii. You know, it was well known that there was a resident spinner dolphin population when we started working out there in 1999, but with some concerted efforts to set up photo ID catalogs for other species, and we have catalogs for 12 species at the moment, and have actually just started a catalog for a 13th species. We have learned that there are resident populations of most of the species of toothed whales around the island. So I think the same goes with the outer Washington coast or the outer coast of British Columbia, is that, you know, you have to find someone who has a good stomach and wants to spend some time out there and start setting up photo ID catalogs with some of these less frequently encountered species in order to answer that question.
That would be some really cool research.
It would, cool, no pun intended, yes.
Yeah, not for me.
Yeah.
So can you take some of the lessons learned from your time in Hawaii and apply it to the situation that we're facing now in Washington State with our southern resident killer whales?
Well, honestly, I think that the situation here in Washington State, we know enough, and we've known enough for a long time, I think, to know what needs to be done to really protect southern resident killer whales. And I was actually asked about this earlier today. So I was involved in preparing the original status review for killer whales in British Columbia for the Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife back it was finalized in 1999, and in 1999 in Canada, they were listed as threatened by Kosiwik, and then in 2001 the southern residents were upgraded or whatever you want to call it to endangered in Canada, and it wasn't until 2005 that the population was listed as endangered in the U.S. and I think as the vast majority of people know and recognize, the problem with southern residents really comes down to not enough food, and not enough food really means not enough Chinook salmon. And it's not just the sheer numbers of Chinook salmon that are important; it's the seasonal availability of enough Chinook salmon up and down the coast that are important. And I think what needs to be done is immediate and concerted efforts to try to help diversify the seasonal availability of Chinook salmon up and down the coast. And I think that's going to require efforts that are long-term and short-term and medium-term in a whole number of ways. And, I think that there are... And this scientific evidence supports that there are other things that are influencing the population, and vessel noise and Navy sonar are certainly among those. But if the animals, as we know from health assessments, are emaciated and they're not able to successfully rear calves, then I don't think... dealing with those other less important issues are where the priority should be. I think something needs to be done to increase Chinook salmon populations. I'm not sure that the Hawaii work really has a lot of relevance for that. I think we already know the answer for Washington State and southern resident killer whales.
Mm-hmm. Anything specific to boost those salmon stocks?
Well, there are short-term and long-term solutions. One thing that people aren't talking about much, and I think people should talk about it. I don't know if it's the the solution, and I should admit up front, I eat Chinook salmon. I've eaten Chinook salmon in the last 2 weeks. I like to eat Chinook salmon, but I think that people need to start talking about whether or not there should be an end for commercial and recreational fisheries for Chinook up and down the coast for some period of time. But the other things that people are also talking about that are probably critical include longer-term solutions, and that's sort of the big and difficult thing that people don't want to deal with, but it's removal of some of the dams. And I know folks are talking a lot about the lower Snake River dams, but, the upper Columbia River populations of Chinook salmon that used to exist 100 years ago are gone in part because of things like the Grand Coulee Dam. And those are cases where there's a tremendous amount of other users, and includes farmers and agricultural uses and power uses and flood control considerations, and all of those things that need to be taken into account. And that's why there's been no action on those, I think. But another potential short term. I hesitate to call it solution, but a short-term measure that I think needs to be considered and has been talked about to some degree is the way that hatchery salmon are dealt with in Washington State. And right now there's been there's been a tremendous production of hatchery salmon, but if you think about it from the perspective of timing, if you have 10 million Chinook salmon that are going to be coming back, and I'm just making up that number of 10 million, if they all come back at one time of the year, that doesn't really solve the problem, because southern resident killer whales are only going to be able to eat a certain number of fish, and salmon spend a large proportion of their life cycle out in the open ocean, and what you need is Chinook salmon to be coming back in the spring, and Chinook salmon to be coming back in the winter, and Chinook salmon to be coming back in the summer, and Chinook salmon to be coming back in the fall. And so the way that hatcheries are releasing their salmon for timing is largely driven by making fish available for recreational fishermen and commercial fishermen along the coast. And if some of that effort is geared towards making fish available year-round, allocating some of those fish, a large number of those fish, really to southern resident killer whales, then I think that would be an important part of the overall, hopefully, solutions to trying to deal with the prey limitations that are occurring. So I think there's a number of options and really in order to, well, the same person who asked me about southern residents earlier today asked how what I thought about the prospects for the population, and I'm not optimistic, and I'm not optimistic because the issues were identified, at least initially identified, 20 years ago, and there's been virtually nothing done to deal with the salmon limitations from the perspective of southern resident killer whales. And I don't mean to ignore the huge amount of time and money that's gone into salmon restoration in Washington State and in the U.S. in general. There's been a lot of efforts and a lot of money, but the folks who are doing that are thinking only about the salmon, not necessarily about the salmon and the species that rely on them. So I think it will require a shift in the way of thinking about how hatcheries, for example, are run, or a shift in thinking about the importance of some of these dams for flood control or irrigation and what can be done to or power generation, and what can be done to help restore some of these systems back to the way they used to be in a way that will benefit species like southern resident killer whales and other species in the environment.
why do you think these things haven't been done for the last 20 years? Do you think people just don't care enough? Is it politics? Is it money? Is it all of the above?
I think it's all of the above. I mean, you know, the Pacific Northwest, at least west of the Cascades, there's a very strong environmental ethic and a very strong concern about the environment, a concern about southern resident killer whales, but that's just part of the state and part of the country, and you know, it relates to these, if you think about the Snake River dams or all the major dams in Washington State that are affecting the ability of salmon, reducing the spawning areas for Chinook salmon. You know, the interests in those include federal agencies, state agencies, Bonneville Power, and when I say state agencies, not just in Washington State, but also Idaho and Oregon. It includes farmers. It includes it includes tribes. It includes a wide diversity of interests, many of whom are not particularly interested in doing anything that will affect their livelihood or in favor of southern resident killer whales. And so, you know, this sort of goes back to educational efforts and efforts to inspire people to care about the marine environment and care about southern residents and care about all the diversity of wildlife in Washington State and in the United States and Canada. Is that, you know, those efforts have to be widespread, and they have to be focused on folks other than just those that live west of the Cascades, because these decisions are being made at multiple levels, and the resistance is coming from multiple levels. And as a researcher, I should also say I think that there's a lot of people who have said that no more research needs to be done because we know what the problem is and we know what the solutions are. And while I agree that we know what the problems are and we know what the solutions are, because of all of this resistance from other groups, that there has to be enough effort, there has to be enough information available for these things to hold up in court. And National Marine Fisheries Service could say, okay, we're going to push forward this particular solution for southern resident killer whales, and then a group can turn around and sue them, and then it comes down to whether the courts are in agreement with one side or the other. And so, you know, efforts to understand the problem are important in the long-term solutions to the problems as well. And I think that's something that people should take into account.
For listeners listening right now to this podcast, what would you recommend that they do personally on an individual level to engage in these issues and to help?
Well, I think there's one really, really important and obvious step that individuals need to take, and that's to vote. And they need to vote for representatives that make supporting protecting the environment, helping recover these endangered species, something that those representatives are going to support. So that's number one. It's really obvious, and it is honestly embarrassing at the relatively small turnout of people in this country. And I should say I have dual citizenship, so I'm going to be critical of Canadians and Americans here, because in both countries there really is not anywhere near as high a turnout as there should be for some of these consequential issues. And then I think there's all sorts of small things that can be done, and that includes getting your friends to vote and getting your relatives to vote. And it doesn't really matter, frankly, who they vote for. It's the voting that's important, because Elected representatives often, I think, feel they can, just get away with representing a small proportion of the population, because only a small proportion of the population is voting, and if a larger proportion actually votes, then I think that is going to truly influence how our government acts. And then the other small things are things like, you know, if you eat seafood, find out where your fish is coming from, find out, you know, whether or not you're eating farmed fish or there are some populations of salmon that are doing very well. Sockeye salmon, for example, a lot of the Alaska stocks of salmon are doing very well. On a smaller scale, fish that are caught really close to the rivers are not taking fish away from southern resident killer whales compared to fish that are caught further away from the rivers, if you think about it that way. I think there's all sorts of things that people can and should be doing that will benefit the environment in general that, you know, may or may not have particularly strong influence on something like southern resident killer whales, but these are all things that people should be thinking about.
And if people want to learn more about your research and everything you have going on, where should they look?
Yeah, well, the Cascadia Research website or the Cascadia Research Facebook page, we post a lot of our publications and information on surveys, both on our Facebook page and on our website. So that's what I would recommend.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us today, and we hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you. Thanks very much.
Thank you all so much for listening today. As always, if you would like to follow our podcast, you can go up to the Whale Scout website and see all episodes in our archives. And you can also subscribe to these on iTunes totally for free. Thank you very much. Namaste.
Thank you for listening to the Whale Scout podcast. Your voluntary donation goes toward the recovery of whale species and enhanced whale watching opportunities in the Pacific Northwest. Please visit www.whalescout.org for more information.
Malatif est trop bien démodé, aussi mal coiffé que rasé, j'entretiens ma gueule négligée.